Anthony Bourdain joins us now to talk about his latest book, Medium Raw, Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and the People Who Cook, which is the August selection of Leonard Lopicio Book Club. It is an account of Mr. Bourdain's voyage from journeyman cook to globe-traveling professional eater and drinker, and he writes of his heroes and villains, evaluates some major figures in food, often negatively, and pays homage to the hardworking men and women behind the scenes in every restaurant. It's recently been published in a paperback edition by Echo, and I'm very pleased that Anthony Bourdain could join us now to discuss it. Welcome back to our show, and we hope that you, our listeners, have read it, and if you have, you can join our conversation by calling us at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a question for him on our show page at WNYC.org. Hi, Tony.
Hey, good to be with you.
Now, this book picks up where Kitchen Confidential left off. You couldn't have imagined at the time that the first book was published just how much it would change your life.
I had no idea. My highest hope was that it would be maybe a tiny little cult success in New York. Never saw it coming.
But it was a career changer.
Almost overnight. I mean, I went from a guy, a no-hoper, standing next to a deep fryer, to a guy with the best job in the world.
One of the things that book conveyed was just how hard cooks and chefs do work, long hours, late nights, weekends. Do the people in the kitchen resent the waiters who arrive not long before the restaurant opens and leave just before the cleanup is completed?
I always hated floor staff for about 5 minutes out of every shift. But at the end of the day, I think, and I like to think that others feel the same way, that we're all part of the same large dysfunctional family. I think that's overstated.
Well, if you're working so many hours, how did you manage to find the time to write?
I think to a great extent I was able to write Kitchen Confidential because I didn't have the time to write. I didn't have time to think about all the very good reasons why it's foolish to attempt writing or about who would possibly want to read this thing. I woke up early in the morning around 5 o'clock and wrote for a couple of hours before I had to go to work.
And with a very strong, distinct voice as a writer. Perhaps if you'd had more time, you would have gotten fussier.
I wanted it. It was a conscious decision to make it sound as I did in the height of the rush in the kitchen. I wanted a conversational, hyperbolic, energetic.
Very frank.
Yeah, I wanted to sound like me talking, and also in a language, in a patois that was recognizable to other cooks, who I have to say were the only people I thought would ever buy the book.
You don't seem to worry about offending people that you criticize, and you often use words in these books that we can't say on the air without being penalized by the FCC. Is it important for you to use all those expletives?
It's the language that I've always spoken, I've always heard. Still, the people I hang out with are mostly cooks, restaurant people. I mean, this is the English language to me. I think to a great majority of people that I've ever met. So I don't see anything deliberately or uniquely profane about it, honestly.
You have a chapter in the book called Heroes and Villains. Can you explain what makes someone like Wiley Dufresne or Fergus Henderson or Grant Achatz a hero?
I think they go against the current. They're taking risks. They're not taking the easy way. They're sticking with their principles. They're in Grant Achatz's case, risking their lives in the cause of what they see as excellence.
Because he had tongue cancer and wound up taking a very risky cure.
Yeah, the doctors, I believe, suggested we're removing the thing. This is the smart thing to do. He did the dumb thing, and fortunately, it's worked out.
But he doesn't have to be a good chef on top of that.
And yet he is.
Another person you clearly admire is Justo Thomas. Can you tell us about him?
Here's a guy, emigre from the Dominican Republic, who has quietly, in an uncelebrated way, stood in the cellar of Le Bernardin restaurant in New York and done an absolutely unbelievably professional and phenomenally quick job of butchering fish for them. Here's a guy who just shows up every day and operates as if every single little movement of his knife is the most important thing in the world. And I admire that.
And he has to produce a lot of fillets that are exactly the same because they can't bring two plates to the table where one piece of fish is bigger than the other.
As he sees it, every single order is the success or failure of the restaurant and his chef, Eric Repair, depends on the knife work of each stroke of the knife. And here's a guy who's doing seemingly an ordinary thing every day, not famous. That to me is a hero. And he cleans 1,000 pounds of fish sometimes in between 8 o'clock in the morning and noon. And it takes 3 trained sous chefs all day working simultaneously to do what he does on vacation.
And you took him to lunch because you wanted him to see the fruits of his own labor?
I hung out with him watching him work and afterwards found that, as with many 3-star quality restaurants, the staff are not generally invited to eat in their own restaurants. So I figured let's see if I can give the guy a chance to see where it all goes.
You contemplate what it means to sell out. What's your definition of a sellout?
Well, it's compromise, any kind of compromise, you're selling out.
Doesn't everybody have to do that to some degree? Go to work for a restaurant, and you have certain ideas about what makes for good cooking, and the owner tells you, no, this is what I want. This is the kind of food I serve, and you wind up doing what you're told, don't you?
If you don't want to put a burger on your menu and yet the public demands it, that's a compromise.
Yeah, or you quit.
Yeah. It's tough. I saw myself as selling out at least a little bit, the minute I went on television. To me, I defined work as standing there in a kitchen doing something physical. So it's a broad spectrum of compromise, I guess.
You also write that you've discovered some of the reasons people like Emeril do what they do. What did he tell you?
Well, he explained to me, and certainly I have come to realize in a personal way, that once you go on TV, you start to... People take a chance on you when they publish your book, for instance. People believe in you. They give you money to write a book. They invest money and time and effort. You feel obliged to at least do your best to help sell that book. You start to take on feelings of obligation and responsibility for the people who have been good to you and helped you along the way to success. And in Emeril's case, I can't even imagine how many hundreds of employees he has. And the beast has to continually be fed to support and grow the lives of the people who've been loyal to him. I get that.
In some cases, you seem to have softened a bit since Kitchen Confidential. For example, with Rachel Ray, who you say sent you a fruit basket.
Yes.
But what bothers you about the Food Network so much?
I ask myself that in the book. Why am I so angry? Why can't I just let it go? I guess because I worked so long in just standing in kitchens cooking on a professional basis, it hurts me physically to see people do bad things to food or disrespect it. And as somebody who's traveled the world, who's been fortunate enough to see people, often very poor people, cooking very well and valuing food, that makes me cranky when I see food misrepresented or disrespected.
Not in the book.
And because I can be just a miserable SOB sometimes.
Well, you've gone after Paula Deen recently. Do you really think she is, quote, the worst, most dangerous person to America, not in America?
I deserve the whacking I got back on that. I hate to beat up on her personally. It's certainly, I stand by the substance of what I said.
You're concerned about all the butter that she sticks in stuff.
I love butter. I feel bad that I stand by the substance of what I said, but I think it certainly came out a lot more crass, personal, and just plain nasty than I intended it. That said, is it necessary to serve a bacon cheeseburger between donuts? Is this what America needs right now? Is this a good thing for America?
What about the people at the Iowa State Fair who were selling fried butter on a stick, and then the Republican presidential hopefuls who were there for the straw poll who ate it as a way of differentiating their attitudes toward diet from Michelle Obama's?
Is diabetes good? Is morbid obesity good? You're celebrating. And in an example like that, first of all, how good can it be? It's a disgusting concept. And it's an immoral one, in my view. You are celebrating something that is, a level of excess and grotesqueness that is leading directly to to terrible health problems. I pointed, you know, I had this argument with Ted Nugent, who actually agreed with me on the one, maybe the one area where we agree. It's a matter of patriotism. It's a matter of military readiness. You know, how are we going to defend ourselves against the enemy if we're all morbidly obese, diabetic, and unhealthy?
One of the people you are critical of, and he's been critical of you, you've engaged in a little war of words, is Alan Richman. And he recently has been criticized for something he is said to have done at M. Wells, the restaurant just recently closed. Were you surprised to hear that a waitress complained that he had patted her fanny a little too vigorously?
I have absolutely no idea what went on there. You know, my opinion on the matter is based entirely on his account, which sounded it sounded like a psychodrama. I really don't know what's going on there. It was the weirdest, like, review or whatever it was I've ever read. Somebody tweeted that it was like a prolonged Yelp review.
He went after a restaurant you used to work with as a way of getting revenge.
I think there's no question about it. I mean, I think that was my big beef with him, is that he was fundamentally dishonest in the sense that he used his power as a critic, as an arbiter, a supposedly non-involved arbiter of taste, to settle personal hash with a restaurant I didn't even work at anymore. And I just found that loathsome.
Well, to some degree, you do open yourself up to this sort of thing. Tom Colicchio said on Page Six that you're afraid of him.
You know, he said, I've never talked trash about him, and that I'm not likely to because I'm afraid of him. I believe that's what he said. I've never talked trash about him, and I'm unlikely to because I genuinely respect and like the guy. So I don't know where that comes from.
My guest is Anthony Bourdain, and he wrote Medium Raw, a Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and People Who Cook, published in hardcover last year, now available in paperback from Echo, and this month's selection on our book club. And I've been asking questions that have actually been sent in by listeners. But we invite your calls as well. Our number here, in case you want to speak directly to Tony, is 646-829-3985. Or, as a lot of listeners have been doing, you can leave a question for him on our show page at WNYC.org. We'll get to some of the other questions in just a moment. But I want to ask about your own television experience. You have a show on the Travel Channel called No Reservations. How did that come about?
We pitched it to, we were looking for my partners and I, who essentially walked out of Food Network years ago when it became apparent that our international programming was unwanted.
Well, it started off as a very different kind of service, didn't it? What happened, do you think?
We had two really good years on Food Network. They let us do pretty much whatever we wanted, go anywhere we wanted in the world and make TV the way we wanted. And when that relationship, when that equation changed, I simply went looking for somebody else to let me do whatever I wanted, wherever I wanted in the world, the way I wanted to do it. And remarkably enough, Travel Channel has been letting me and my partners do that.
Although, in some cases, putting yourself in danger. Weren't you in Beirut filming when the war broke out there in 2006?
Yeah. I hadn't planned on, you know, doing a hard news or any show like that. But, you know, I guess you travel long enough to some of the places that we go, bad things happen.
Well, you went to Kurdistan, didn't you?
Yeah, and I'm really glad I did. That was a rather extraordinary, it was a very extraordinary experience. I like learning stuff, you know. I mean, to me, there are a lot more distinguished ways to make a living than being on television. The fact that it, you know, the challenge to me is to continuously make it interesting to me, to continue to learn and keep it interesting for my crew as well.
So do you assume that if you go to a place that some people might consider dangerous, that it's not really going to affect you because you're not about to go into the front lines of the battles? You're going to the restaurants?
You don't know. We had to take high intensity or hazardous environment training before we went to Iraq, and they do their very best to scare you, and they did. We had to learn how to treat sucking chest wounds. We were issued tourniquets before we went. And in places that I've been, like Liberia, Haiti, there are a lot of places where the civil infrastructure is limited, and a you know, a small situation can become a big one very quickly.
So what happens to the food in places like that, in Haiti, where which is still recovering from a terrible earthquake, or Iraq, where you went this summer, where there's, I'm assuming it's still hard for farmers to get their produce into the big cities because the markets are often blown up by suicide bombers.
Often, you know, to me, the story of food is so often people being forced to cook well because they have to find ingenious ways to do a lot with very, very little. That's become sort of a focus of the show. Food, you know, people say, no, I hate it when you know, you should never talk about politics on the show. And we try not to, but there is nothing more political than food. Not only what people are eating, but what they're not eating. Who's cooking? These are, you know, sort of essential to society. I'm trying not to do it, any kind of political show, and yet that intrudes more and more as we continue to do it.
And we have Mark Bittman writing up at pieces for the New York Times, talking about the politics of food. Many others have also been doing that. Michael Pollan, for example. Mm-hmm. Is it possible these days to not do it? Alice Waters has come under attack from others, to some degree from you as well, because she talks about food in political terms.
Well, I mean, I think you make decisions, you know, whether you're buying sneakers or a loaf of bread, you're making decisions that have consequences. I think we're all rowing in the same direction, me and Alice Waters. I think you have to be sensitive to the fact that right now this is a lot of the decisions that she's talking about making are the province of the privileged.
Well, there's a trend lately on respecting ingredients, focusing on where they come from, how they are grown, and looking at a food system as a whole, which is mm-hmm. something that Alice has been talking about. She would say that it should not be for the privileged, that food policy favors the bad food, that we give subsidies to the big agribusiness farms.
She's right.
Yeah.
She's right. Absolutely. I think she's not a particularly good spokesmodel for her cause. You know, she comes from an area rich in delicious things. She's comfortable. She has very elitist tastes that she has a very hard time concealing. Actually, that's Alice Waters I like. I mean,
I loved eating at Chez Panisse, and I thought the food was not all that fancy.
No, but I mean, her love of Provence, for instance, and the Mediterranean sensibility is both charming and not helpful. You know, I think that in order to convince people in West Virginia to eat better, that I don't think either me or Alice Waters is particularly good spokesperson for that.
Along those lines, Mary Norman from Tenafly, New Jersey, left this comment on our website. I know you live this side of the bridge. You mentioned it on Bill Maher last week. Why do you think there are so very few interesting, innovative restaurants over here? Mm-hmm. Why are most of them in the land of Oz, I mean New York City? And as a follow-up, I would ask, despite all the talk about food, there are still a lot of places in the country where you see little but Red Lobster, Olive Garden, Applebee's, no local restaurants.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, those are tough competitors. First, the Jersey question is the one I asked. I asked Tom Colicchio, actually, who's fellow Jersey guy. The money's not out there. People, if you go through the trouble and the difficulty of working your way up in the kitchen, you become a celebrated chef. The money and the fame is in nearby New York City. So that's one reason. And also,
there are people with money in some of these towns, Montclair, for example.
I don't understand why a community like Montclair doesn't support a two-star Michelin quality or a one-star Michelin quality restaurant, and why there don't seem to be many in New Jersey. I think it's that's not where the cooks are, because the cooks run off to New York City. That would be one reason. I don't know. What they do have is an exploding an influx of Asians, of Koreans and Japanese in New Jersey, which has transformed it from my time.
Let's take a call. Aubrey from Brooklyn, how you're on there?
Hey, Leonard. Hey, Tony. I'm a big admirer of yours. I had a quick question. I've got a friend who's a cook in a professional restaurant. pretty prestigious. And, you know, I know from reading your books and, you know, watching your program that being a professional cook is, there's a lot of anger and frustration that can be involved in the job. And I think he's feeling a lot of that. And I was wondering, at what point do you sort of decide whether or not to just throw in the towel, or whether or not you should just keep going and just hope that it gets better?
Now, what kind of anger are you talking about?
You know, just frustration, I think, with the general, I mean, this isn't me, this is, like I said, a friend of mine, but what just sort of general anger and frustration towards, like, people you can work with, the hours, you know, the underpayment, the underappreciation, and things like that.
It's really, really, really tough. There's so much frustration and futility. I mean, there's a reason why substance abuse and alcoholism is so traditionally endemic in the restaurant business, why the life expectancy of the chef and the cook has traditionally been ridiculously low, why smoking is so the rate of smoking is so high in the restaurant business.
Dull your taste?
The majority of chefs I've ever met smoke. Mm-hmm. It's a dirty little secret. Does it dull your taste? Yes. When do you draw the line? When you are drinking, when you realize that you have a substance abuse problem that's destroying you and the people around you, that things are spinning out of control, that the joy and satisfaction you're getting out of the business and the possibility that things are going to get better are outweighed by the destruction around you, then I guess it's time to get out.
Well, you went to the Culinary Institute of America. What's your advice to the students there now, or some of the other culinary schools, or anyone else who's contemplating a career as a chef or a restaurateur?
Well, I think the big thing is, before you go to a culinary school, you know, work in the business for a while, for free if necessary. You know, understand, you know, find out what it's like. Find out, you know, look in your own heart after a few months working in a busy restaurant and decide, am I going to be happy in this business? Well, do I love it enough to go through what I'm going to have to go through? Have also a reasonable expectation of what kind of money you're going to be making when you get out of the Culinary Institute. It's not going to be much.
Unless you become one of the super, superstar celebrity chefs.
And the likelihood of that happening is pretty remote. You better really love cooking, and you also better be the sort of person who loves all of that craziness and futility and stress and rage and crisis. You know, it takes a special kind of person and not a normal person to be happy.
Ed from Staten Island, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I love all of your shows and books, Mr. Bourdain.
Thank you.
You know, growing up in public schools in New York, I was always taught how to have an open mind about other cultures. And you know, while I was a mediocre student, I was always totally thrilled by our classes that really told us to respect other cultures. That seems to have deteriorated after 9/11, probably even before that. I personally think food is a great way for us to regain that. I personally like to see you as Secretary of State of our country. And I was curious if you could consider, if you thought some of the next election cycle, if it would be something that you could instill in our politicians to realize that to make Americans understand that they are not alone in this world, well, that it's not just a bowl of a faux or something else, but if it was just that, realize where it came from.
Okay.
You know, I think it's a great question, because it applies as much to what I've learned sitting down with a Saudi family, for instance, or, you know, Vietnamese family, and seeing what we have in common.
But it's different when you go there and you experience it than if you eat in a restaurant here?
Yeah, because you're the guest. Mm-hmm. You know, people are proud of their food, their culture. It's a very pure way to communicate. But, you know, I would turn this on its head. I've become a lot more forgiving of my own country. I would turn this question on its head and say, you know, I may not have a lot in common with the Tea Party, for instance, but I'm guessing that we'd have a pretty good time sitting down and eating beer and drinking beer and eating barbecue with anyone of any political stripe.
Dr. Susan Ribbon from Westchester, we have to do this very quickly. We're pretty much out of time. She left this comment on our website. I'm a huge fan of Bourdain's books and TV shows. Now that he has a kid, he will get a new view of the toxic food environment. Will he take a bold stand on school food? I know in the book you talk about trying to wean your kid off of McDonald's in the weirdest way anybody has ever tried to do.
Well, I tried to terrorize. I've used they have no problem messing with the minds of small children. How hard is it to scare the hell out of a 3-year-old? You know, so I've made the effort to terrify my daughter and demonize fast food and make it scary and not cool.
And made Ronald McDonald into a villain.
Yeah, I see nothing wrong with that.
A listener wants to know about the closing of El Bulli.
It's history. It's over.
I had my chance. Didn't go. We will be announcing in our next hour what our next book club selection is. You can sign up for our newsletter at WNYC.org. I've been talking to Anthony Bourdain about his book, Medium Raw, Bloody Valentine in the World of Food and People Who Cook. It is published by Echo. Thank you so much for doing this with us.
Thank you. It was fun.